It's a great pleasure to address a very broad and varied audience such as yourselves. So thank you all very much for coming here. So I'm going to be talking about work we've done over approximately the last 10 years on mutations, and I'll describe what a mutation is in a moment. And most of my talk is going to be concentrated on mutations in humans, but I will talk a little bit about mutations in chimpanzees and also mutations in a variety of other organisms. Okay, so let's start at the very basics. So every human individual, such as Lance Armstrong here, I'm a very keen cyclist, so that's why I put him up here. So every individual is composed of cells. And in fact, there's about 50 million cells in your body. Now, in each of those cells, there is a very small but very long molecule, which is our DNA. So it's this beautiful double helix structure, which you've probably all seen at some stage. So the DNA is our genetic material. This is the material that encodes the instructions which allow us to build another human person. Now, that DNA is essentially composed of four building blocks, and these are typically given the letters A, T, C, and G. So these four letters, and that's all there are, they're just four building blocks, these four letters are strung together in a very, very long sequence of letters. And it's those letters which encode the information which allow us to build a new human being. Now, this string of letters, and I should say at this point, I'm going to try and avoid jargon, but occasionally I will lapse into it. There are two terms I'm very likely to use. I will refer to our genome, and that is our total length of DNA. So each of us has a genome, which is this long string of letters. And occasionally I might refer to chromosomes. So our genome is broken up into these 23 chromosomes, which you're probably all familiar with. But hopefully that will be the only jargon I'll use during this lecture. If I start to make no sense at all, please stop me. Right, okay, so we've got this string of letters, and this is truly a very, very long string of letters. So it is, in fact, 3.4 billion nucleotides, or letters, in length. Now, in this day and age where we're throwing around billions left, right and centre to save the banking industry, we forget really how big a billion is. So a billion is, of course, a million million. So if we were to type out our genetic code, so our string of letters, if we were to type that out in 12-point Courier font, so that's a sort of standard kind of font that you would use on your computer, then it actually, the human genome would actually stretch for 5,500 miles. So it would stretch from us here in this lecture theatre all the way to Los Angeles, all the way to Johannesburg, or all the way to Beijing. Well, to put that slightly differently, if we were actually flying to any one of those locations and actually trying to read our genetic, our genome, we would actually have to read 88,000 letters a second to do so. So the human genome is this huge entity. It's very, very small, but it's very, very long. So we inherit our genome, one copy of our genome from our father. If we're lucky, we might inherit it from David Beckham. And one copy of our genome from our mother. And we might also be lucky if we were inheriting it from Victoria Beckham. And during that process of inheriting our genome, the genome has to be copied. You have to make new copies. And in fact, on average, you copy this long sequence of letters about 75 times, going from parents to offspring. So Brooklyn Beckham is the product of his mother and father's DNA, and hopefully he's going to inherit his father and mother's good looks, and hopefully also his father's ability to play football, but hopefully not his mother's ability to sing or inability to sing. So during this process of inheritance of DNA, there are mistakes made. So occasionally one of these letters will be changed. And so in this instance, we're just imagining that Brooklyn's inheriting his father's DNA with one single change in this short sequence. So this G has become T. So this is a mutation. So this isn't the only type of mutation we have. We can have single letter changes. We can have multiple letter changes, and that's something we've been studying quite recently. We can also have the loss of letters, the gain of letters, and the rearrangement of letters. So there are all different types of mutations that you can get. But the most common type of mutation is this single letter change, and that's what I'm going to be concentrating on today. So everything I'm going to be talking about is about these single letter changes. So this is the process of mutation, and there are a number of questions you might ask about this process of mutation. First of all, why do mutations occur? So why are we getting mutations? Secondly, we might want to know what is the rate of mutation. So how many new mutations do each of us receive from our parents each generation? And finally, we might want to know what are the effects of those mutations? So in this lecture, I'm going to be concentrating on the last two questions, what is the rate of mutation and what are the effects of these mutations? So what do I mean by effects of mutations? So mutations can have a variety of effects on our fitness, on our ability to produce offspring. So ultimately, the sort of ultimate aim of evolution is to produce offspring. So there are some mutations which are harmful, which are deleterious to us. These stop us producing offspring, either by reducing our chance of surviving to reproductive age, or if we do survive to reproductive age, reducing the probability that we will actually produce viable offspring. So there are a number of genetic diseases which are classic examples of harmful mutations. And one such mutation is one that the folk singer Woody Guthrie suffered from. So he suffered from a condition called Huntington's chorea, which is caused by a mutation. And this is a very nasty disease. It's a neurological disease, neurological degeneration. Most individuals actually suffer from this in their 30s and 40s, but there are a few individuals who actually suffer from it very early in life. And if they suffer from it early in life, it is basically fatal, and those individuals do not produce offspring. Woody Guthrie was actually a little bit of an exception. He actually went on to live into his mid-50s and actually had 8 children. So this mutation, which is harmful in many individuals, was not actually harmful in his particular case. So I've paired him here with Bruce Springsteen, a very young picture of Bruce Springsteen, and I've paired these two together, basically because Bruce Springsteen is a great fan of Woody Guthrie, and as far as I know, Bruce Springsteen doesn't have any major deleterious mutations, although, like all of us, he has harmful mutations in his genome, and that's something I'll come back to. So that's these harmful mutations, and those are mutations we're probably all familiar with. These are the mutations which contribute to things like heart disease, diabetes, schizophrenia, and all these single mutation problems, things like cystic fibrosis. So then there are mutations which are positively beneficial to their host. These are the mutations which help organisms adapt to their environment. And a classic example of this is a mutation which occurred in these moths. So this is a moth called Biston betularia. And during the Industrial Revolution, so the sort of ancestral form of this is a light-coloured moth, which is reasonably camouflaged on most tree trunks. But during the Industrial Revolution, there was huge amounts of soot being pumped out, and basically, certainly near major cities, all the trees turned black. And as a consequence, this light-coloured moth was rather at a disadvantage. Now birds could see it. Its camouflage was blown. But there arose a mutation which actually turned this moth, this pale moth, into a very dark-coloured moth. And you probably can't see it, but here is this other moth. So this is a dark form. So the mutation which converts this pale moth into this dark moth is advantageous in the environment when you've got a lot of black tree trunks sitting around. And there's been some very nice experiments showing that birds actually will preferentially pick off these light-coloured forms relative to these dark forms. So that's an example of an advantageous mutation. And then finally, there are some mutations which are the indifferent mutations from my title, and we call these neutral mutations. So there are many mutations which appear to have little or no effect on the organism in which they arise. So I've illustrated this by actually having two identical photographs. So there may be several neutral mutations differentiating these two plants, but essentially they look identical because those neutral mutations are having no effect. So let's start thinking about these questions that we want to address. And the first one we want to think about is, what is the rate of mutation? So what is the rate at which we get new mutations from our parents? Well, it turns out that one thing we know about mutations is that they are incredibly rare. So it's currently impossible to compare, say, your genome to your parents and identify the mutations that differentiate you. So we need another strategy by which we can estimate the mutation rate. So we can't directly observe the mutation rate, so we need a sort of alternative way in which we can do that. And we can do that basically by comparing different species, by comparing the DNA sequences of different species. So here we've got George Bush and a chimpanzee. They probably have some genetic difference between them, maybe not that many. So it turns out that if we can find a part of the genome in which most of the mutations are neutral, then in fact the rate at which those mutations accumulate between two species, these neutral mutations, actually is equal to the mutation rate. So if you can find a part of the genome in which you think most mutations are neutral, then the rate at which those sequences diverge in different species is exactly equal to the mutation rate. In other words, if we compare the sequence of a human and the sequence of a chimpanzee, we can estimate how many mutations have occurred between them. Now, we need to find these neutral sequences, and it turns out that that's not particularly difficult. We believe that probably upwards of 90% of our genome is actually essentially of no consequence at all. So most of the mutations in that sequence are neutral. So if we compare humans and chimpanzees, their sequences in these neutral regions, then we find that they're about 1% divergent. So what this means is that, on average, humans and chimpanzees have had one mutation every 100 letters of their genetic code. Of course, that's only part of the story, so this is telling us how many mutations have occurred between humans and chimpanzees, but actually really what we want to know is what is the mutation rate per generation. And to know that, we've got to know how many generations separate humans and chimpanzees. So I'm going to tell you that the average generation time in humans and chimpanzees is probably somewhere around 25 years. Well, you might think that that's rather high, because we know that humans certainly can reproduce in their early teens, and they often do, certainly in our society, and indeed chimpanzees can also breed in their early teens. But what is crucial here, first of all, is that it's the average generation time. So it's the average age of parents giving birth to offspring. That's what we have to concern ourselves with. And the second thing is to realise that actually in more natural human populations, the average age of females giving birth to offspring in either humans or chimpanzees is actually very, very in the upper 20s. So if you look at human hunter-gatherer societies, and three have been studied, the average age of a female giving birth to an offspring is around 28 or 29 years. Actually, the average age of males having those offspring is actually somewhat older than that. It's actually in their 30s. Even if you look at wild chimpanzees, the average age of a female chimpanzee giving birth to offspring is around 23 years. And the reason that the average generation time is really quite high when the minimum generation time is quite low is basically both in chimpanzees and in human societies, females do not tend to reproduce as early as possible. They tend to reproduce in their late teens or early 20s, and then they continue to produce offspring for quite a long time. So the average generation time is probably somewhere around 25 years between humans and chimpanzees. So now we need to couple that with an estimate of how divergent we are in terms of our time. So humans and chimpanzees diverged between 5 and 7 million years ago. I'm just going to take a figure of 6 million years. So if we take 6 million years and divide it by 25, well, in fact, 12 million years, because you've got 6 million years of divergence from humans back to their common ancestor, and then 6 million years from the common ancestor back to chimpanzees. So we've got 12 million years of divergence. If the generation time is 25 years, that means that the number of generations separating humans and chimpanzees is around 500,000. Okay, so now what we can do is take our estimate of the number of mutations which have occurred between humans and chimpanzees and divide it by the number of number of generations, and that will give us an estimate of the mutation rate per site per generation. And when you do that, it comes out to be 2 times 10 to the minus 8 per site per generation. So to put that a slightly differently, what this means is that one mutation, if you're studying a particular site, then one mutation occurs every 50 million generations. So the fidelity with which this DNA is copied is really truly astounding. It's copied with remarkable fidelity. So these enzymes which are copying your DNA over and over again are only making a mistake every 50 million generations at a particular site. But of course, the rate per site is very low, but the actual size of our genome is very, very big. And if you combine those two facts, what you come up with So we're going to multiply the rate per site by the size of the genome. We're going to then get an estimate of the number of mutations occurring per individual per generation. And it comes out to be about 130. So although the fidelity, so although the error rate is very, very low per site, because we've got such a huge genome, we actually end up with an awful lot of mutations. So we end up with about 130 new mutations each individual, each generation. Now, I'm just going to have a little bit of an aside here, and that is tell you a little bit about my working day. This is really stealing the idea from Andrew Little, who had a similar kind of concept in his professorial lecture. So exactly how do I do this, or how do we do this? So I'm not doing this alone. I have people working with me. So how do we do this? Do I actually go into the lab? Do I have some chimpanzees, stashed in my office somewhere, which I'm taking DNA from? The answer is no. In fact, all I'm doing is sitting in my office and actually pulling these sequences down over my computer from the internet. So there are various laboratories across the world whose principal aim is to actually sequence DNA. So sequence things like the human genome, the chimpanzee genome, mouse, rat. Genomes are popping out all over the place. So there are these big centres, and one of them is just south of Cambridge at Hinxton. There are these big centres which basically are sequencing DNA, and then they put them on publicly available databases, and I basically sit in my office and download that information and then use a combination of statistical analyses and mathematical models to basically analyse that data and to make inferences. So my life is basically confined to this office, which is usually very messy, as you can see. Okay. So that's, how we do this. So now let's come back to the sort of main focus of the talk. So I've told you we're receiving these 130 new mutations each generation from our parents. So each of us is receiving, on average, these 130 new mutations. And one of the things that we're very interested in right at the moment is whether those mutations tend to occur at certain points in the genome or whether they're kind of uniformly distributed across our DNA sequence. So it's known, in fact, that the rate of mutation of a particular letter does depend to some extent on the flanking letters. So it might be that A, when it's flanked by T, has a low mutation rate, and A, when it's flanked by C, has a high mutation rate. So it's known that there are these what we call context effects. So it depends, the mutation rate at a site depends on the letters either side of it. Now the classic example of this is what's called the CG effect. So if you have the letter C followed by the letter G, these two letters have a very high rate of mutation. And the reason they have a high rate of mutation is this C, when it's followed by G, is methylated. So that sort of basic building block has got an additional chemical group added to it. Don't worry about the details, it's not very important, but it turns out that this methylated cytosine is unstable and it tends to spontaneously change into another letter. So as a consequence, these CG pairings of letters actually have a very high mutation rate. They have a mutation rate which is about tenfold higher than the background mutation rate. So one of the things we're interested in is whether there is other variation in the mutation rate, which is not associated with these simple sort of pairings of letters. So we've been recently sort of searching for evidence that there might be sites in the genome which are hypermutable, which tend to generate mutations at a very high rate. And the way that we've done that is actually to look where mutations occur in humans and chimpanzees. So we can do that, in principle, in the following way. Each of us has got a genome sequence from our father and a genome sequence from our mother. If you sequence those bits of DNA, found out what the sequence of letters is, and compare them, you would find some differences. On average, you find a difference about every 1,000 letters as a difference between any randomly chosen genome sequences. So these are mutations. We can do the same thing in chimpanzees, and we'll find mutations. In fact, you find rather more mutations in chimpanzees than in humans. Now, if these mutations are kind of randomly distributed across the genome, in other words, if all sites are equally likely to have a mutation, then the position of these mutations in humans will be random with respect to the position of the sites in chimpanzees. In contrast, if you have some sites which are, say, hypermutable, then we would expect those sites to generate mutations in humans and also generate mutations in chimpanzees. So we've recently done an analysis along these lines. So we've looked to see how many instances we can find where we have a mutation in humans and a mutation in chimpanzees at the same site. We found about 12,000 of them. And then we can calculate how many we would expect to see, assuming that mutations are random across the genome, taking into account the fact that certain pairs of letters actually have higher mutation rates than others. So when you do that, you find that your expected value is around 7,000. So there's about a 70% excess of sites at which you've got a mutation in humans and a mutation in chimpanzee. And what that's telling you is that there are some sites in our genome which are hypermutable. They tend to produce mutations too frequently. Now I'm going to go on to a rather subtle point. So these hypermutable sites that we found, we know they're not associated with the particular pairs of letters either side. But actually it turns out that they do appear to depend on the general pattern of letters extending about 80 base pairs out from them. So what I got plotted here, and I thought I'd just show you this because this is a sort of graph that I deal with and look at on a day-to-day basis. So what we got plotted here is some measure of how non-random the letters are either side of the sites at which you've got both a human and a chimpanzee mutation. So the human and chimpanzee mutations are in the center here, and this is a measure of how non-random the letters are either side. And increasing non-randomness here. So you can see that as you come into this site at which you've got both a human and a chimpanzee mutation, you get increasingly non-random sequences. The problem is, when you actually look at those sequences, they don't make any sense. There's nothing, no obvious pattern to them. So we're really quite perplexed by this. There appears to be some sort of non-randomness, but we have so far failed to detect or understand what that non-randomness is. Just to show you the contrast, if you look at sites at which humans have got a mutation but chimpanzees don't have a mutation, then you don't see this sort of increase in non-randomness around these mutations. Okay, so just to kind of sum up, so we found these hypermutable sites, and they do depend in some complex way on the letters that surround them. And we're very interested in trying to understand what those context effects are. We can also infer that the rate of mutation that we're seeing is really very, very strong. So we estimate that the fastest 5% of sites, the sites which mutate the fastest, actually mutate about 16-fold faster than the lowest 5% of sites. So there really is very substantial variation in the mutation rate. So that means that some sites are much more mutable than other sites in the human genome. And really one of the things we're very interested in is actually then trying to tie this to human disease mutations and asking whether the mutations which are associated with human disease, are these mutations actually occurring at these hypermutable sites that we've identified? So that's a project for the future. Okay, so I've talked a little bit about the rate of mutation and how that rate is distributed across the genome. And I want to turn my attention to the effects of mutations. So what effects are mutations having? So if you remember, I told you that mutations can essentially have three types of effect. They can be harmful to us, they can be positively beneficial to us, or they can essentially leave us unchanged. So really what we would like to know is what is the relative rate, or what are the rates of harmful mutation, advantageous mutation, and neutral mutation? Well, each of those questions is quite difficult. So what I'm going to show you is some analyses where we've been getting a handle on the rate of harmful mutation. And I'm really going to show you sort of two different analyses which impinge upon this question. So how do we estimate the rate of harmful mutation? Well, as I told you earlier, actually directly estimating the rate of mutation is very difficult, and we managed to infer the rate of mutation by comparing sequences from different species. In a very similar way, we can actually infer the rate of harmful mutation by comparing sequences from different species. However, there's a slight subtlety here, and that is that, in fact, we infer the presence of harmful mutations by the fact that we don't see them. So I'll explain that. So let's imagine that we were comparing the genome sequences from, say, a human and a fish. These diverged about 400 million years ago, so they're really quite divergent from each other. You might see the following pattern. You might see regions in which you've got lots and lots of changes. So the red letters indicate that humans and fish are different. They have a different letter. So you can see there's lots of changes here, and there's lots of changes here. But in the middle here, there are no changes. There's perfect conservation between humans and fish in this sequence. So what this is actually telling us, well, is that most likely many of the mutations in this sequence are harmful. So why can we infer that? Well, mutations are occurring in this sequence, they're coming into the population, but because they're harmful, they're being removed by natural selection. And because they're being removed by natural selection, then they never get fixed in either human or fish. So these mutations, these harmful mutations, can never contribute to the differences between species. So the indication of harmful mutations is basically a lack of change. And you can actually estimate the proportion of harmful mutations by comparing the level of divergence you see here to the level of divergence you see here. So just to reiterate that, essentially we're kind of assuming that many of the changes here are neutral. We're inferring that many of the changes, the mutations here, are deleterious. And again, many of the mutations here are neutral. So by comparing the rate at which these sequences evolve, you can actually estimate the proportion of mutations which are harmful. So when we do that, we still don't know what proportion of the human genome is subject to selection, in the sense what proportion of the mutations occurring in the human genome are harmful. What we do know is a lower bound on that. We know that at least 2% of all mutations in humans are harmful, because essentially we don't see them in divergence between species. So now we can take that lower bound estimate on the proportion of mutations which are harmful and combine it with our estimate of the number of new mutations which occur each generation, and this allows us to infer that on average each of us receives 2.5 harmful mutations each generation. So each of us is receiving on average 130 new mutations, and at least 2.5 of those are harmful. Now you're probably thinking, well, 2.5, that's not too bad. We can probably all cope with 2.5 harmful mutations. But actually, it turns out that that is really quite a high number, and it's a high number in two different contexts. The first thing is, if we repeat this sort of analysis in other species, we actually come out top. And although we like to be top, you don't want to be top in terms of the number of harmful mutations you've got. So we've repeated this sort of analysis for old world monkey and new world monkey, sheep, cow, dog, cat, chicken, quail, mouse, rat, and a bunch of fruit flies. So this is a rather strange bunch of creatures, but of course these are the creatures that people go out and sequence, and they sequence them for one of two reasons. Either they want to eat them, or they want to keep them in the lab. So that's the reason we've got things like chicken and quail. The Japanese are very fond of quail, and therefore they've been sequencing an awful lot of genes in quail. And we're rather fond of chicken, and we've been sequencing an awful lot of genes in chicken. And, of course, we like our pets, and so we're very interested in studying their diseases. So we've sequenced lots of sequences in dog and cat. So, as I say, we're at the top of the tree here with at least two and a half deleterious mutations per individual per generation. And this puts us about at least 2.5 times higher than our next rivals, which are the monkeys. And you can see there really is quite substantial variation in the mutation rate. Orders of magnitude variation, so more than tenfold variation in the mutation rate between different organisms. In fact, there's a very nice relationship between the mutation rate per generation and generation time. So this is what's plotted out here. We've got the generation time of organisms going from short generation time organisms to long generation time organisms, and this is their deleterious mutation rate per generation. So what this nice curve tells you is that we would expect most long-lived organisms to have high rates of harmful mutation and most short-lived organisms to have low rates of harmful mutation. Okay, The second context in which this is really quite a high rate of mutation is if we make a rather naive calculation about the proportion of individuals which actually fail to reproduce because of these harmful mutations. So these are harmful mutations, they're stopping individuals reproducing, and we can actually calculate exactly what proportion of the population, under a fairly naive sort of model, what proportion of the population would fail to reproduce because of these. Well, it turns out to be 92%. So these, we would naively expect these 2.5 harmful mutations to actually basically eliminate the reproductive potential of 92% of the people in this auditorium. Or to put that slightly differently, that means that each female would, on average, have to produce 25 offspring to actually maintain our population size. So clearly we don't have that sort of reproductive excess, and clearly 92% of the population are not failing to reproduce. So when we first published our estimate of the harmful mutation rate in humans and drew attention to this rather strange result, this actually got picked up by the creationist lobby, and the following article appeared, and I think it's still there, www.evolutionfairytale.com. So, monkey-man hypothesis thwarted by mutation rates. So the high mutation rate from the Airwalker and Keatley study was determined under the assumption of common ancestry between chimps and man. Since the rate is clearly too high, there are clearly only two realistic explanations. There is a mistake in their data or analysis, doubtful, very encouraging. Or the base assumption that man and chimp share a common ancestor is flawed, most likely. Well, of course, we do believe that humans and chimpanzees had a common ancestor, and not only that, that common ancestor lived about 6 million years ago. So there really is something to explain here. How can we tolerate this high rate of harmful mutation? Well, as in many things in science, really, it's not so much that we don't have explanations, but in some ways we have too many explanations. So I'm just going to go run through a couple of those. The first possibility is that, in fact, maybe a lot of selection, so the harmful effects of these mutations, are actually being experienced before birth. So in humans, about 80% of all pregnancies do not actually go to term. So it may be that a lot of those do not go to term because there are deleterious mutations in the developing fetus. The second possibility is that these mutations actually interact with one another. So that naive calculation of what proportion of the population has to die or fail to reproduce because of these mutations, that was made under the assumption that mutations are independent in their effects. But we know that many mutations interact, and if they interact in a certain way, then that mutation load can be considerably smaller. Unfortunately, we don't really know which of these is the most likely explanation, and there are several others which we could think about. Okay, so coming back now to thinking about the effects of mutations, so I've given you an estimate of the rate at which harmful mutations come into our population. But in fact, we don't know how harmful those mutations are. All we know is that they are sufficiently harmful to be removed by natural selection. And actually, that doesn't have to be very harmful. So mutations could have effects of 1 in 10,000, and those mutations would essentially be removed by natural selection. So we've got these 2.5 harmful mutations coming into our population, and we actually don't currently know whether they have effects of 1 in 10,000 or 1 in 10. And of course, there's a big difference between those. So again, this is quite a difficult problem to address, but we've been making some progress. And the way that you can kind of... So what we would really like to know is what proportion of these harmful mutations are strongly deleterious, mildly deleterious, slightly deleterious, and some of them are probably going to be effectively neutral. They're going to have effects which are so weak that we can essentially treat them as neutral mutations. So we would like to know what this distribution looks like. And we can get a handle on that by actually looking at variation in DNA sequences from within a species. So let's imagine that we sequenced a part of our genome from a variety of different individuals, and we've got these DNA sequences. And you can see there's some variation here. Well, it turns out that that variation allows you to infer something about this distribution. And I'll try and give you a little feel for why that is. Start off by considering these strongly harmful mutations. Well, these strongly harmful mutations are probably so harmful that they'll come into the population and the individual that's carrying them will either fail to reproduce or die as a consequence of these harmful mutations. So those mutations get removed very, very quickly. In contrast, these neutral mutations, they can come into the population and they can basically, because they're not doing anybody any harm, they can actually reach very high frequency in the population. In contrast, these slightly and mildly deleterious mutations, they're rather different. So let's imagine they reduce your probability of producing offspring, say, by 1 in 1,000. Well, therefore, they can come into the population, and generally they're not that harmful, so they can segregate to quite high frequencies. So just through random processes, they can increase in frequency in the population. But, of course, they are slightly harmful, and therefore, generally, they will be at lower frequency than these neutral mutations. So basically, using the variation from within a species, we can infer something about this distribution. And I'm not going to go into many details about how we do that. I'm just going to flash up some fancy equations in the hope of trying to impress upon you that occasionally we do something complex. Anyway, I'll move rapidly on. This is the only sort of technical slide I'm going to put up. Right. Okay. So what we would like to do is apply this methodology to all mutations. But actually that turns out to be very difficult to do right at the moment for reasons that I can't really go into. So actually what we've had to do is focus in on just one part of our genome. And we focused in on what are called the protein coding sequences. So in your genome there are these sequences which code for proteins. And proteins basically build bodies. And only 1% of our DNA actually codes for these proteins. But we know these are important. Without our protein coding sequences, we wouldn't be alive. So many of the things like, Huntington's chorea, the mutation which causes that is a mutation in a protein. What does the other 99% do? So the 99% of our genome is non-protein coding. Well, this is a mixture of regions which regulate these protein coding sequences. And probably quite a lot of this DNA is what we call junk DNA. It's just there for no real reason. And that's, of course, a very interesting story in itself, and I don't have time to actually say anything about that. So we're going to be concentrating on mutations which occur in these protein coding sequences and trying to infer how harmful are those mutations. So we've applied our method, and this is basically what we get. So the most frequent type of mutation are mutations which we might call strongly deleterious. So about 45% of all mutations are inferred to be strongly deleterious in the sense that they have effects of greater than 1 in 100. Well, you might think, well, 1 in 100 is not that deleterious. Unfortunately, we can't resolve this any further. So that's just kind of limit of our method is to see up to 1 in 100. But in evolutionary terms, certainly 1 in 100 is quite strong selection. The other big category of mutations are mutations which are effectively neutral. So around 30% of all mutations in humans are so weakly selected that we can essentially treat them as neutral. And then the minority of mutations are these 25% of mutations, which are slightly or mildly deleterious. They're probably of great interest because these are ones which are probably contributing quite a lot to some of the complex human diseases. So I'll just elaborate on that in just a moment. So one of the consequences of the particular shape of this distribution of fitness effects is that each of us is carrying around about 1,000 mildly harmful mutations. So this is a combination of the fact that many of these mutations are not that deleterious and we have a high rate of harmful mutation. Combine those two together and you come to the conclusion that each of us is carrying around 1,000 harmful mutations. So that means that none of us are perfect. The interesting thing, of course, is that these harmful mutations, which are segregating in our population, these are contributing to many of the diseases which have a strong genetic basis. So things like heart disease, schizophrenia, diabetes, these are all very common diseases in human populations, and they all have a strong genetic component. So, if your parents suffered from heart disease, then the chances are you may well suffer from heart disease. Of course, environment is also very important. It matters whether you exercise, what you eat. So we're very interested right at the moment in the connection between what we can understand about this distribution of fitness effects and what we can understand about disease mutations and, in fact, the likelihood of being able to find these disease mutations. Right, so that's all I'm going to say about harmful mutations. I'm now going to move on to what may be the most interesting type of mutations, advantageous mutations, the mutations which help us adapt to our environment. Now, if we compare two species like humans and chimpanzees, and these are definitely more closely related than 1%, because our genome is so big, okay, so we're only 1% divergent, but because our genome is so big, this means that there are about 34 million differences between humans and chimpanzees. And even if we concentrate down, so many of these are probably neutral because they're in this junk DNA, but even if we concentrate down on the protein coding sequences, which we know are important, then there are about 60,000 amino acid differences between humans and chimpanzees. So a question that's intrigued evolutionary biologists for a long time is what proportion of this 60,000 amino acid differences have been driven by adaptive evolution? In other words, what proportion of these differences have helped humans adapt to their environment and chimpanzees adapt to their environment? So we can get a handle on this by actually using variation from within a species, so taking DNA sequences from multiple human individuals and comparing those to at least a single sequence from a different species, say chimpanzee. So you will see there's some differences between chimpanzee and humans, and there is some variation within the human sequences. And it turns out just by having that variation within species and those differences between species, you can start to work out what proportion of the substitutions that differentiate those species, what proportion of those differences have actually been driven by adaptive evolution. In other words, what proportion of those have been advantageous to each species. I should say at this point that I'm telling you all about comparing between humans and chimpanzees. All the results are pretty much unchanged if you actually look at humans alone and chimpanzees alone. I've just stated all the results in terms of the divergence between humans and chimpanzees because that's rather easier to explain. Otherwise, I would have to explain how you can split the human lineage from the chimpanzee lineage. So all these results are general both to humans and to chimpanzees. Right. So we can go out and we can ask what proportion of the changes we see in protein coding sequences are due to adaptive evolution. And the first species that we looked at were the good old friend, the fruit flies, Drosophila. And in this species, about 50% of all amino acid differences are a consequence of positive selection. We then moved on to enteric bacteria, and the bacteria we were looking at were E. coli, so that's the bacteria that's in our gut, and Salmonella enterica, which is the bacterium which is in a bird intestine. Of course, occasionally Salmonella gets into us and gives us rather nasty diseases. When you compare these two species, again, we see very high levels of adaptive evolution. So more than 50% of all amino acid differences between these two bacteria have been driven by adaptive evolution. So just very recently, we've actually got some results from mice. And in mice, it gets even higher. So it's about 70%. So hopefully you're seeing a fairly consistent picture here, which is that when we look at the differences between species in these protein coding sequences, an awful lot of the differences appear to have been a consequence of adaptive evolution. So what do you think is true of humans? You know, what's the situation going to be in humans? We like to think of ourselves as the ultimate species, the top of the tree. But in fact, we have the lowest rate of adaptive substitution that's yet been estimated. So around 6%, this is just significantly greater than zero. It's about as close to zero as you can get without being zero. So for some reason, we have a very, very low rate of adaptive evolution in our species. This is also true of chimpanzees, although chimpanzees, rather bizarrely, have a slightly higher rate of adaptive evolution. So this is something that really is intriguing us as to why humans and chimpanzees should have such low levels of adaptive evolution when everybody else is adapting like crazy. Of course, we have adapted, and there are some very classic examples, very well-documented examples of adaptive evolution in our species. We have adapted, but we haven't adapted that much. Okay, so I think that brings me to tie up and just give you a brief summary. So what I've shown you today is that humans have a very high rate of mutation. and that mutation rate is highly variable across our genome. I've shown you that we have at least 2.5 of these 130 mutations, about at least 2.5 of these mutations are harmful to us, and that in fact a lot of those have moderately strong effects of greater than 1%. The consequence of these two facts is that we're probably all carrying around lots of mildly harmful mutations. And finally, I've told you that we have very low levels of adaptive evolution. So actually putting these ideas together, you see that, in fact, rather than being the sort of pinnacle of evolution, in some ways we're not actually a very good species. We've got lots and lots of harmful mutations kicking around in our species, and we're not adapting very fast. We still survived, and we're still doing rather well, but I don't know, for how much longer? Right. Okay, so I'm just going to now just think a little bit about the future. So what does the future hold for the sort of work that I'm doing? Well, there is an absolute deluge of data. So in my field, right at the moment, technology is advancing at a ridiculous rate. And this technology is meaning that, you know, we've gone from sequencing one human genome at a cost of probably tens, if not hundreds of million dollars, and we're very close to being able to sequence a single human genome for about $10,000, and we'll see a human genome sequence for about $1,000 very soon. And you can sequence a human genome literally within weeks now. And there is now a project out there to sequence 1,000 complete human genomes. So there's just this huge amount of data which is being produced, and that is going to allow us to address many of the questions I've been talking about today in ever more fine detail. We'll be able to really look at various aspects of mutation, how they occur, where they occur, etc. So some of the questions, leading questions we're very interested in is, why is the rate of adaptation so low in humans? And actually, a sort of related question, does that matter? Does it actually matter that our rate of adaptive evolution has been so low? We're doing okay. Chimpanzees are doing okay. So what does it really mean to adapt? Or to put it another way, what's all this adaptive evolution doing in things like fruit flies? We're very interested in the distribution of fitness effects of mutations and what that might tell us about human disease, and in particular the probability of being able to detect mutations associated with human disease. And of course we're interested in the connection, as I told you about a bit earlier, between these mutation hotspots and disease causing mutations. So, okay, that just leaves me to thank a number of people. First of all of you for sitting here and listening to me. Also the University of Sussex for employing me and giving me a very stimulating and pleasant place to work. And then I'd like to thank a number of people with whom I've worked over the years on various projects that I've mentioned today. So Nick Smith, Nicola Bierne, Megan Wolfitt, Ted Phelps, Jane Charlesworth. Jane is in the audience. Alan Hodgkinson, who's currently with me, and Nina Stoletsky, who's also currently with me. These are both, I think, in the audience. I hope they are. And finally, a very big thank you to my longtime collaborator up in Edinburgh University, Peter Keatley. Much of what I've talked about today, I've collaborated with him on over the last 10 years. So thank you very much. And,